You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll learn about the steps the state wants to take to address issues surrounding Alzheimer's and dementia.
First, when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of legalized same-sex marriage in 2015, it was a major victory for gay and lesbian rights in the United States. And public support for same-sex marriage is at an all-time high. The latest polling from the Pew Research Center finds that more than half of Americans support same-sex unions.
Well, our next guest acknowledges that we live in an era of considerable advancement and change for LGBT rights. He says that gay, lesbian, and transgender citizens are still too often considered less than whole and are still lacking full legal protections against workplace, housing, family, and other kinds of discrimination. And as we saw in the wake of the mass shooting at a gay club in Orlando this past weekend, there's still anti-gay prejudice to be found in the United States.
Stephen Engel joins us now. He's associate professor and chair of politics at Bates College. He's also an affiliated scholar at the American Bar Foundation. His new book is Fragmented Citizens, The Changing Landscape of Gay and Lesbian Lives. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's go back to early 2015. Public support for same-sex marriage was at a record high, more and more states legalizing it, and the Supreme Court was getting ready to have the final say. Yet, as you say, it was still a disorienting season for gays and lesbians in the United States. What else was happening around that time that spoke to this idea of less than whole citizenship?
Well, I think, you know, on the eve of the Obergefell decision, which, of course, was that decision that declared bans on same-sex marriage unconstitutional, you have, and I use a vignette to open the book, about tax season, right? And so when you're filing your taxes as a same-sex couple, prior to Obergefell, in some states you are recognized as married. In some states, that might carry forward for the federal recognition, but in other states that would not be the case. Or, for example, if you celebrated your wedding in a state, the federal government that recognized it, the federal government would recognize it, but that might leave some others out. And so you had to file multiple types of tax returns. And so the state would essentially render your relationship apart in the tax filing. There were some other issues going on. This was about the same time that there were some Religious Freedom Restoration Acts that were coming down the pipe in Arizona and then later in Indiana that were attempting to curb recognitions of LGBT equality in favor of First Amendment rights of religious expression. And so you had this tension between equality that followed from the 14th Amendment versus religious expression that might follow from the First Amendment. And then, of course, that gets tangled up in a lot of discourse about the ways in which companies and firms would either bring business into a state or not, depending on what their approach to LGBT equality was. And so I think it was disorienting for all of these reasons. In part, I think, even after Obergefell, the status of gays and lesbian citizens is disorienting, and this is the theme I explore in the book, precisely because it is contingent on the governing issue in which you as a citizen are interacting. So, and on the issue. So, for example, if I were married, that relationship might be recognized by the federal government or by the state, but I might live in a state that doesn't recognize my status to, say, equal employment or equality in public accommodations. And so depending on the policy issue, the status of my citizenship, of my equality, is rendered unequal or fragmented.
So you've touched on a few of those, but let's look more closely at some of those big areas where inequalities and legal discrimination are still present. So you mentioned the workplace. What are some of the issues for gay and lesbian people in the workplace and having workplace protections?
Right, certainly. Well, there is, in fact, no ban on discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity in terms of workplace discrimination in over 25 states. There's also no ban on discrimination in public accommodations on gender identity or sexual orientation in over 25 states. Now, this has actually been a very interesting moment. What I mean by that is that there is, in fact, no law, federal law, that, like, say, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that includes sexual orientation or gender identity as a specific category that is protected from discrimination. So if you were to look at the 1964 Civil Rights Act, it mentions things like race, sex, color, creed, etc., and sexual orientation as a phrase is not in there. More recently, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has ruled that sexual orientation and gender identity might be covered under the concept of sex. This has been a concept that legal theorists have played with for over 20 years, that, for example, sex discrimination or sexual orientation discrimination, to take one example, is actually a version of sex discrimination. Because what we're saying when we're discriminating against someone who is gay or lesbian, we're saying that that person, precisely because they have romantic feelings for someone of the same sex, is violating a sex stereotype. Mm. And violations of sex stereotypes are, in fact, a form of sex discrimination or you know, not conforming. The expectation that one conform to a sex stereotype is a form of sex discrimination.
Another aspect that you address in the book, and you kind of touched on it in an interesting way with tax returns. So one of the things that people often do on a tax return is claim a dependent, a child, and adoption, and also being able to have two same-sex parents listed on a birth certificate, for example, and all the rights that come with that. That is also something that is not guaranteed for same-sex couples.
Oh, yes. I mean, the status of second parent adoption or step parent adoption for same-sex couples, it very much varies by state. There have been some definitive laws that said, you know, bans on same-sex adoptions. And in most cases, those absolute bans have most recently been struck down. But it still does leave the status of same-sex parents, whether two parents of the same sex can be listed on the birth certificate, is still a very gray area, and it does depend in the jurisdiction state by state. So to make this sort of like a very real situation, I have a very good friend who went on the academic job market a few years ago, and he and his husband, and they have two children, and they were restricted in their job search after graduate school. So they could only go to certain states where their status as parents, that they were both equally recognized as fathers, that they would have employment discriminations if they had a job at a public institution, that they could make sure that benefits would match up with the partner status. This differs state by state, and so it affected their abilities to, you know, go on the job market fully.
We're talking with Stephen Engel. He's associate professor and chair of politics at Bates College, and his new book is Fragmented Citizens: The Changing Landscape of Gay and Lesbian Lives. Now, there are, in several of those topics that we just covered, there is the issue of what is a federal right, what has been granted by certain states, and there are some people that will say this is an issue of states' rights versus federal rights. How would you address that?
Well, I do think that there is a claim, a historical claim, where there, you know, that states' rights is certainly something that we value, because what we're saying is there's a principle in our Constitution of federalism. There are conflicting principles with federalism that are also in our Constitution. The guarantees of equal protection and due process and privileges and immunities of citizenship that follow from the 14th Amendment, I think, are just as strong. And so we have to come up with a way in which what is the balance between those two principles, or in fact, what do we value more? Do we value the way in which states can make decisions, or do we value the notion that if you are a citizen of the United States, then you are guaranteed certain fundamental equal rights as all other citizens of the United States. Taking, as a constitutional law professor at Bates, I take a historical view towards this, and I would argue that the 14th Amendment, coming on the heels of the Civil War, radically transformed the meaning of the Constitution. That if you look at the Bill of Rights, for example, the first 10 amendments, the target of those 10 amendments was really restricting Congress. It was restricting the federal power in favor of the state power. After the Civil War, we see a reversal where we are actually restricting state power in favor and empowering the federal government to protect citizens directly. And I think as a sort of a developmental moment, we have to think about whether or not we've come to a place where citizenship and equal citizenship is perhaps a more valuable principle than states' rights, especially if those states' rights have been used historically as cover for what we would now consider to be discriminatory action.
So we are about a year out from that landmark Supreme Court decision saying that same-sex marriage is legal in the United States. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, in that past year, since then, more anti-LGBTQ bills have been introduced than in any other year in recent history. They count at least 140 state bills introduced across the country, and they anticipate even more next year. This is all while public opinion continues to shift towards greater acceptance. Is there an easy answer for why that is?
Well, I don't think there is an easy answer. I mean, I think that's exactly what I'm trying to explore in the book. I think we tend to view that dynamic of, say, a social movement win, like the Obergefell decision, and then we see a kind of pushback, a politics of counter-movement mobilization. So we might include in those, you know, the past year of legislation, the RFRAs, the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, or something like HB2 out of North Carolina. And I think that while there's something true to that, this is a kind of a social movement and then a kind of counter movement pushback, I think what we're also seeing is that political change in the United States is always partial. So altering laws in one domain raises to the surface tensions with laws and policies in another domain, right? So you have a sort of shift in marriage. And what that suggests is, you know, raises to the surface new inequalities, or it highlights, brings to the fore new inequalities. People stake their positions out on maintaining or trying to dislodge those new inequalities, like what I was saying earlier, this tension that we now perceive between religious expression and a claim towards equal rights. You know, the canonical case of the wedding cake baker who doesn't want to feel compelled to provide a wedding cake for a same-sex marriage.
We're talking right now with Stephen Engel, author of Fractured Citizens, about the changing landscape of gay and lesbian lives in America and the legal protections he says they still lack.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. What's next for the LGBT movement in America? Do you see legalized discrimination against gay and lesbian citizens? And do you think there are changes that need to be made? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking right now with Stephen Engel, professor and chair of politics at Bates College, and author of the book Fragmented Citizens. And we're looking at the challenges faced by LGBT Americans and what hurdles to full equal citizenship, he says, still remain.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What direction do you see the LGBT movement taking next? Do you see legalized discrimination against gay and lesbian citizens at the state or federal level? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And actually, Stephen, we do have a caller on the line. Gary in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. Interesting show. I just it seems to me that so many gains have been made so fast, and you know, I never hear any gratitude at all, like, thanks, America. I mean, you know, like, we've done a lot here for the LGBTQ plus movement, more than probably any other country, or at least we're doing our best, you know, and it's like, holy cow, you know, marriage has been changed, and that's a jarring thing to a lot of people. Changing the definition of marriage was a big deal. And, you know, so there have been a lot of games. Will there be pushback? Of course there'll be pushback. I mean, until everyone's silent and nods in agreement and hugs everybody, is that what we need to do? This is America. We're going to have differing views, and I think gay, lesbian, you know, queer, all that stuff have made a lot of gains. So I don't hear any gratitude ever, though. Never. It's always grievances.
All right. Thanks for that call, Gary. And Stephen, how would you respond to that comment?
Well, I think Gary is right that there has been a fair bit of change, but I would question whether or not the change is coming at a pace that is lightning fast, in the sense that we think about the marriage debate as kind of a really radical shift, say in the last 10 years. You know, if we say starting with the Massachusetts decision in 2004 and then Obergefell in 2015, you know, in the span of a decade, that is a pretty radical shift. But I would suggest that, you know, from a historical perspective, the fight for marriage, if we just take that one right, that actually stretches back significantly, at least into beginning in the mid 20th century. So these are not short spans of movement mobilization. The LGBT movement has been pushing for equal rights and equal recognitions for quite some time. And I question whether the claim is that the LGBT, those of us who identify as LGBT, should somehow be grateful to the rest of the community for acknowledging that we are, in fact, part of the community. We are citizens. We participate with rights and responsibilities that accord to citizens, and so it is only fair that we are recognized as such. And it is the case, as I pointed out earlier, that equal recognition is not fully there. And I think, in particularly in light of this past weekend shootings in Orlando, I think we're at a very sort of painful and sobering moment in LGBT rights progress. I think what has been revealed is the highly contingent status of what many thought was a steady trend towards equal and dignified recognition. And what Orlando, I think, calls us to reassess both what forward motion should look like for the LGBT movement as we push forward, but it also, I think, reminds us that rights struggles don't necessarily happen in a kind of singular forward or progressive momentum, that, in fact, there is a lot of pushback, as the caller suggested, and that these are sort of long hauls. Despite the rhetoric of the arc of history bends towards justice, that's not necessarily the case. There's a long history in the United States of, the passage, say, for example, of the 14th Amendment, and then 100 years of history where we simply ignore that amendment.
I want to touch on Orlando again, but I also want to bring Mary from Milwaukee in the conversation now. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I just want to comment to your last caller that said the LGBT community should be saying thank you. Why? They have the same rights that the rest of us do. I just don't understand that. And I don't think we're progressing in this area anymore. I think we're taking big, huge steps backwards. And I just am appalled.
Well, thank you for that call, Mary. And I think what we see with Mary and Gary both expressing their opinion, Stephen, is that there is still a lot of disagreement and discussion about these topics.
Well, I definitely think that is true. And I think when we ask whether or not there is progress in this area, I would suggest that, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book was I think that no one could deny, and if we bracket the violence in Orlando to one side for a moment, I think no one could deny that there's a particular subset of gay or lesbian individuals, cisgender, white, those with financial means, that the sense of equal treatment under the law has greatly improved for those individuals over the last two decades. But I wonder, I think we have to think very clearly about what about those in our community who are not cisgender? What about those who are not of a particular financial status or have financial means? What about those queers of color? And what is their level of equality, of their level of equal treatment? I think when we think about what is the next push for the LGBT movement, I think it's quite true that there has been some progress, particularly for particular kinds of gay and lesbian citizens, but a lot more remains ahead.
And just as we prepare to wrap up, in light of that shooting in Orlando, the victims were predominantly gay people of color.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some calls to not use the tragedy for political ends, but others say that everything else in the lives of LGBTQ people gets politicized, so why not something like Orlando? How would you respond to those two positions?
I think that's a very delicate topic. I want to be extraordinarily respectful to the families, the friends, the victims of this horrific shooting. At the same time, I do think that something very valuable can come out of that moment by making a political statement, by saying that maybe it is time once again that pride celebrations that occur throughout this month of June take on a little bit more of a political stand, that, in what we thought was a moment of great celebration because of marriage, for example, the one-year anniversary, that what Orlando demonstrated was that there's so much left to be done, and that maybe it is time to think about pride celebrations as less of commercialized parades and more as political protest movements.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a very interesting and informative discussion.
Thank you. I had a pleasure.
That was Stephen Engel, Associate Professor and Chair of Politics at Bates College. He's also an affiliated scholar of the American Bar Foundation. His new book is Fragmented Citizens, The Changing Landscape of Gay and Lesbian Lives.
Here's a situation you might be familiar with. You go shopping for some clothes. You go from one store to another. You're still the same person, same size, but the clothing size that was too small in store A is too big in store B.
And that might be because of vanity sizing, a practice that assigns smaller sizes to clothes to appeal to customers who want a boost from wearing that smaller size. In a world where being thinner is often equated with being attractive, especially for women, the smaller number on the tag might make some shoppers feel better about themselves, but it can also make shopping really difficult for people. Here's a clip from the show Inside Amy Schumer, where Schumer goes to a trendy retail store in search of a shirt.
Can I help you find something?
Do you have this in a larger size?
Have what in what?
This shirt in a larger size.
Have you checked under the table?
No.
Good luck.
No, these are even smaller.
Could you keep your voice down? You're scaring the thinner customers.
Sorry. I just need just this in a size 12.
Like a UK 12, which is a US 8? Or like a Japanese 12, which is an American toddler 3.
Eliana Docterman is a culture writer for Time magazine in New York City. She wrote about her own experience shopping for clothes and about the history behind sizing. Her article, One Size Fits None, is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Eliana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, lead us into how you decided to follow this issue.
Well, so we had been having conversations, my editors and I, for a long time about frustrations with shopping, how we seem to be one size in one pair of jeans and a completely different size in another pair of jeans. And the conversation sort of picked up, actually, when Amy Schumer was included in Glamour's issue of plus-size women embracing different body types. And she got into a back and forth with them where she said, this is great that you're doing this, but I'm a size 8, and that's not plus size. And so we started to talk about the lexicon that we use around sizing and the numbers around sizing and trying to figure out why there isn't just one standardized sizing across all of the U.S., and I began to look into it, and it turns out the reason is it's incredibly complicated to try to assign sizing to people. And so there's so many variety of body types, especially for women and especially in the U.S., where we have so many different types of people and so many different types of bodies that it's impossible to have just one universal sizing system that everyone can follow. So what you end up with is you might be a size 2 in one store and a size 8 in another.
Yeah, and on one hand, this is a frustrating nuisance for people shopping. And on the other hand, as you point out, this blurs into issues over things like body image and expectations of how women dress and what they look like. This is an interesting, annoying issue with some serious consequences, it sounds like.
Yeah, it does have some serious consequences. Part of the problem is vanity sizing. Just to give you a sense of how bad vanity sizing is, which is making the label on the piece of clothing with a smaller number, even though it might have been the same size, the same measurements as it was a few years ago, Twiggy wore a size 8 in 1967. And now somebody like Mindy Kaling has been open about being a size 8. So that's the difference. You know, Twiggy was a model who was known for being extremely thin. Size 8 used to be the smallest size available in the U.S. That's a size 00 today by the same measurements. So the sizes have been shrinking in order to appeal to women because they feel good when they're in a smaller size. But it also helps perpetuate this idea that smaller is better, which isn't necessarily the case.
And does it look like this is an intentional effort from people who design and market clothing, this vanity sizing?
Yes, absolutely. I spoke to people within the industry, professors at fashion schools, who talk about how there is still this idea within the fashion community that they are designing for a certain type of body type, and that body type is almost always very thin, white woman. So that is the body that they are designing for. And the fashion industry has had a hard time thinking about diversity in many different types of ways, in its advertisements, in the way that it designs clothing, in the people that it's marketing to. And so they've had a hard time embracing women who are curvier. So that's been a big problem for them, and I think that the transition's starting to happen. One of the people that I spoke to was Melissa McCarthy, who, along with being this movie star, had this experience where she was going on sets and they were having to Frankenstein clothes for her together because she couldn't find something that was flattering and that fit that she wanted to wear on screen. And, you know, there is a troop of people who just look for clothes for these stars to wear in movies, and they couldn't find anything. And so what she eventually did is she started making her own clothes, and then she launched her own clothing line. And she said, when I spoke to her, I don't understand why, you know, more designers don't launch clothing lines that include larger sizes because, you know, 67% of American women wear a size 14 or above, and so there's a huge market there.
Let's take a caller. We've got Maddie on the line in central Wisconsin. Maddie, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Maybe just a little insight with my dealing with the fashion world over the years from the late 50s and 60s. And I was aware that there could be a size 12 in one store, but you go to the high end and a little more exclusive situation and you could be a size 2. But that's been for many, many years. And I kind of think that still holds true because I have some clothes that are size 6 and 2, and I would put myself in the middle range between a 12 and a 14. Now I have items, I feel like taking that size tag and putting it on the outside of the garment. Oh, this is a size 2. I know I'm not a size 2, but indeed, dealing with retailing years back, there would be women coming into a store. Oh, I'm a size 8. Where are the 8s? Well, I would kind of size her up a little bit and think, no, sweetie, I think you need a 12, but if you want an 8, take it to the fitting room. And then she'd come back and say, oh, but it doesn't fit. It's too tight. but it depends on the store you're going to and the price that you're paying. And I think that pretty much holds true today.
Maddie, thanks. I want to get Eliana Doctorman from Time Magazine back in on this. I mean, that was back then. That's now. This is a big chore going from store to store. You take that clothing in the size you think is the right size for you, and who knows what you're going to get in the fitting room.
Right. And we looked at measurements across many different brands, many common brands that people shop for, and found, for example, that a size 6 pair of jeans can vary by as much as 6 inches in the waistband. And if you think about that, that's a tremendous amount. It would be impossible to tell if you were walking into a store you'd never been to before what size you could possibly be. So this has been an ongoing issue for a long time. And the fashion industry doesn't necessarily have the incentive to resolve it because if you find the brand that you like, you'll stick with that brand and try shopping for that brand. The one thing that may change this, and this is beginning to change, is that people are starting more and more to order clothes online. And it's very frustrating when you order something online and it arrives and it doesn't fit you. And it's impossible to tell without trying it on first whether it's going to fit you or not. We think of that as a small burden to us because we can have free shipping and return it back. But the company that sent it to you has to pay for the shipping, pay to repackage it, pay to inspect the clothes. If the season has changed, maybe it goes on sale. So it's actually a very large cost to them. So they're finally starting to be motivated to try to figure out how to get you into clothes that fit you when you shop online.
Right. I imagine that the technology is there. We can drive a rover around on Mars. It seems like we could come up with a consistent sizing standard for clothing. Why hasn't that happened?
Right. So actually, as with many problems in America, Silicon Valley is trying to hack the problem. So in this case, there have been several startups, many of which I talked to and visited, who are trying to use basically big data to solve this problem. They look at your shopping history, they look at what fit you before, and then they try to pair you with a piece of clothing based not on the size of the clothing, but the actual measurement of the clothing. One of the very popular companies that's doing this is called TrueFit. And so TrueFit partners with many different stores and sites. Nordstrom's is one of them. And once you go on there, they will ask you, what is your favorite shirt? What brand is it? And what size is it? And based on that, they can tell you which shirt will fit in what size in a different brand.
Right. When I think about it, it seems ridiculous that we try to size people with a one number system because people are different heights, shapes, sizes, weights. They might be the same weight. The weight's proportioned differently. Like, is it even possible to have a one number system that's going to be useful to people?
Right. So part of the problem is that when Americans and the government did try to create a universal sizing system, and they undertook this immense project where they measured thousands and thousands of women. And what they came up with was so many different types of measurements because women can be curvy in so many different ways that there was no real way to distill that into a system that would really work. What they came up with was size 8 through 38, and then they had letters, tall, regular, small, and then symbols, plus or minus. But all of that led to complications for any sort of clothing producer that's trying to create clothing. You know, that's so many different things that you have to create and order and know how much to order, and it's very unwieldy. So what ended up happening is that clothing manufacturers basically reverted back to, okay, we're doing this in a basic 2, 4, 6, 8, 12 sizing system.
We're talking to Eliana Doctorman, culture writer at Time Magazine, about the history and present and maybe future of clothes sizing and why it can be so hard to find clothes that fit.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you shop at stores that use maybe this vanity sizing or mark clothes, larger clothes with smaller numbers? How do you think the fashion industry should set the size standards for clothes? And should the fashion industry be expected to contribute to its consumer self-esteem? You can let us know what you think, and if you work in the fashion industry, tell us what your thoughts are on this. 800-642-1234 is the number to call.
Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Eliana Doctorman. She's a culture writer for Time Magazine in New York City. She's talking to us about some of the history, the thinking behind vanity sizing and clothes, and why sizes vary so much. And it's hard to find clothes that fit, especially for women.
And we want to know what you think. Do you often find that the size of clothes at retail stores doesn't always match the way they fit? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you ever feel like clothes aren't always made for your body type? And if you shop online, we also want to hear from you. Tell us whether you find it easier or harder to find those clothes that fit you and your body. Our number is 800-642-1234.
Back to our callers now. Mary is with us in Racine. Mary, hi.
Hi. I wanted to tell that I sew and I made a wedding dress and two bridesmaids' dresses for three young women. And according to the pattern envelope, they were all supposedly the same size, but one was short, one was tall, one was medium, and they had all different shapes mixed in among them. So they were totally different.
Hmm.
And the only way to get through it was to fit each dress on each person separately and make the needed alterations. It was a nightmare, but that's how clothing is.
Don't leave us in suspense, Mary. Did it end up working out? Did you end up coming with dresses that fit everybody?
Yes, it did. It worked out well.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Mary. Yeah, so there you go, Eliana, somebody who's making these clothes by hand, realizing you have to really tailor it to particular women.
Right, and that's sort of the interesting thing is that as early as the 1940s and 50s, that was normal to either make your own clothes or tailor your clothes to fit you or have them tailored to fit you. And so this has been a problem really just in the last 50, 60 years where we are buying off the rack and it's no longer the norm for women especially to have clothes tailored. Of course, men tend to have suits tailored. That's a service offered with buying the suit. But for whatever reason, that has not been a part of women's clothing.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Lauren in Marquette, Michigan. Lauren, hi.
Hi. I've been listening to this, and it's interesting because I've wondered. I'm old. I'm 67, and I've wondered for most of my life why women's clothes weren't sized the same as men's are. You know, when you want trousers, you get a waist in inches and a pant length in inches. When you want a shirt, you get a neck in inches, a sleeve length in inches, and a chest in inches. And I've heard you say for the last 10 or 15 minutes that women are all so different.
Mm-hmm.
So why doesn't the industry just measure them?
Lauren, thanks so much for that call. I was a little confused. You said you're old, and then you said you're only 67. But why don't, I mean, if I go buy pants, I have two numbers on it. Still, there's a lack of consistency sometimes, Eliana, but we can do all these things for men. There are shirts you can buy off the rack with those measurements, like you said. Why isn't there more of that for women?
So there are two reasons for that. The first of which is that women's bodies differ in a way that men's bodies don't differ. We have busts, we have hips, different size busts, different size hips, different size waists. So it's more complicated to make a dress for a woman than, say, a shirt for a man and to size that up and down as opposed to a shirt for a man. The other reason is that in this 1958 study throughout the 40s and then which culminated in actual this study in the 1950s, the government measured 15,000 women, and they measured everything from shoulder width to thigh girth. And what they concluded, they had all of these measurements, but one of the things that they found was that women did not like sharing their measurements with store clerks. And you can imagine why. It's similar to having to share your weight, of course. It's so loaded what your measurements are that for women who live in a world where they're judged on how they look all the time, it is a very loaded question to ask a woman what her weight is, let alone what her measurements are.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Eliana Dochterman with Time Magazine, talking about clothing sizes, how inconsistent they are, and why that is. We'll go back to our callers now. Michael is on the line in Green Bay. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I identify as a transsexual female. My body, I'm still biologically male, and I fall within the hip-to-waist ratio of a female. And I have a lot of experience sizing the subject of the clothing issue, and what I've decided would work is more of a unisex system where you give a waist measurement, a hip measurement, and a length measurement where a female can go in and simply, or a male can go in and pick a pair of jeans or a size that simply fits according to measurements. That, you know, for women, it would be, the difference would be slightly in whether it's a high rise or mid rise or low rise waist. That changes quite a bit. And with that said, math doesn't lie. I think it should go back to a system for both men and women where you have a waist measurement, a hip measurement, and a length measurement, and there's no guesswork. And I understand that women want to feel smaller or they're afraid to give sizes, but this, when if you're ordering online or you're ordering where you're not being, where you can't put the clothing on, this is a true measuring type system where you would know exactly what you're getting.
Michael, thanks for sharing your experience and your idea. Would that be something that could work, men and women using the same, this is for pants we're talking now, specifically the same sizing system, Eliana?
So there are a couple of startups that do something like this. One of them is Latote, which only serves women right now, but I believe they're talking about expanding into different types of clothing for all different types of people. But what they do is they have you enter in your measurements, and it's a subscription service, and they will send you clothing each month depending on those measurements. So it's an idea sort of like that, where they are giving you clothes based on measurements as opposed to sizing. I think that near term, that is going to be the solution, is that you have a startup or a separate company that steps in and does the sizing, as opposed to the change in the fashion industry as a whole, because as I kind of mentioned earlier, the fashion industry has been very, very stuck in their ways in how they think about clothing, how they design clothing, and who they're designing clothing for. And I think it would be very hard for one company to step out and say, okay, this is the method that we're going to use to do this, when the other companies are increasingly saying, you're a size 4, you're a size 2, and flattering customers make them feel better. Studies show that people are more likely to feel happy and therefore purchase clothing if they feel smaller in it.
Michael, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Alex with us in Milwaukee. Alex, hi.
Hi. So I've been listening for a while, and I actually heard something about this with Tim Gunn, as far as women who are plus size having a hard time finding clothes and something. I'm only 22 years old, and so when I was younger, I was about 4'8", and I weighed about 130 pounds. And being a 13-year-old girl and already having body dysmorphia problems and having a bad body image, when you are being forced to go into the women's section to find clothes, that just adds on to the types of problems that girls have. And so, especially not only for older women, the fashion industry should try to market clothing better for all types of younger women, because they have those problems starting early, and if they're just compounded by the fashion industry just continuing to make women forced to feel small and be small.
Alex, I want to jump in and give Eliana a chance to respond. Thank you so much, Alex, for sharing your experience. Eliana, briefly, your thoughts on that for girls, too, she's saying.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. As she said, Tim Gunn has been very outspoken about this, about the lack of designers who are willing to design for different body types. And lots of, Beyonce has spoken about this, Melissa McCarthy has spoken about this. These are women who are considered some of the most beautiful women in the world. They're actresses and pop stars, and they have trouble finding clothing to fit their bodies. And part of the problem is also when you're going into a store and going into what's often a different section of the store to look for larger sizes, it's often dimly lit. You see a lot of people complaining on social media, especially about how it's dimly lit, how all of the mannequins are still thin. It makes you feel bad about your body. If you try to go shopping with people who are a different size than you, you have to go to a different part of the store than them. It's a very demoralizing experience, and I think especially for young girls.
That's Eliana Dochterman. Thanks to her. She's a culture writer for Time Magazine in New York City. We've got her piece on vanity sizing in the fashion industry linked over at the Central Time Facebook page.